You are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 8th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history at the University of Chicago, Jonathan Levy, author of Ages of American Capitalism, A History of the United States. Also on the program today, House passes a nearly $8 trillion, over the course of 10 years, defense bill by a vote of 363-70. 50 Democrats, 19 Republicans voted no. I guess one independent maybe voted no as well. Meanwhile, the Senate votes down an attempt to block arms sales to Saudi Arabia. It appears that there will be a vote tomorrow on the debt ceiling. Mitch McConnell may allow for a scheme that allows the filibuster be temporarily disabled. Didn't know you could do that. Meanwhile, Congresswoman Presley to introduce a resolution to censure Lauren Boebert. And Saul Omarova, the banking regulator, attacked by Republicans as a commie because she was born in the Soviet Union, backs out of her nomination ultimately because Mark Warner and John Tester needed to do the bidding of the banks. Jury's still out on Omicron. But Pfizer claims data shows you're going to need a booster. Sort of already knew that. A Trump court appointee blocks the federal contractor vaccine mandate. And a Trump court appointee basically defangs congressional oversight. National Labor Relations Board mails ballots tomorrow to workers at three Buffalo area Starbucks. Apparently, despite the fact that the Holocaust happened. Ron Wyden and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau get an end to the sharing of consumer data with ICE. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Emma Viglin is here to remind us that today is hump day.
Hump day.
It didn't even occur to me until I was in the middle of introducing you.
Yes, well.
And I knew you were going to come back. That's your staple.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I wish I kind of, if I had known it would be my staple, I would have come up with something a bit better, but.
No, did you coin that mm-hmm. term?
Yeah.
Hump day.
You almost said cump.
Did I?
Clump.
Coimp? Whatever.
And now you coined cump.
There you go. I don't even want to know what that means. But, well, congratulations. It's because a lot of people use it now.
Now you have to pay me royalties.
I didn't realize that, but that's why I never say it. Yes, the app is back on, ladies and gentlemen. That was not a function of us. Apparently, these Amazon servers were out for all sorts of businesses. So you can always listen to the show on the app. You can IM the program via the app. The app is free at majorityapp.com. Also, a reminder, Majority Live is where you get your tickets to the live show. We're holding the show on January 16th, and it is the Big Lie show. The Big Lie show.
Yeah, and I just booked my travel yesterday. So
there you go.
Getting very excited.
You are. So you will be coming.
I will be there.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. That's good to hear.
Yep.
I gotta check my calendar.
Yep, I had dinner with a couple of our other guests who are going to be coming.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Are you feeling it after yesterday?
Yeah, I'm feeling it. I am certainly feeling it. That is without a doubt. Just a reminder, and also check out our merch store. We've got a lot of stuff going on there these days. Stuff I can't quite follow, but a lot of it's a lot of activity.
So, updated by the minute.
Yeah, on a rolling basis. Check that out. And always, as always, justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. So when they need to get stuff done, they get stuff done. And it is just the reality that our country is, in many respects, run by the forces that make money off of our military-industrial complex. And it is not just as a private enterprise. Over the years, starting 60 years ago, maybe a little more, the defense industry, the military, figured out the best way to make sure they had the votes that they needed to get more money every year was to have everybody invested. We're going to put a base in everybody's district, or we're going to put a factory that makes a part for a weapon in everybody's district. And obviously it's not in every district, but that's what leads you to something like a 363-70 vote on a bill that is now five times, I can't even do the math, five times plus, six times, maybe five times more than the very controversial bill that would actually bring direct and material benefit to a vast number of people in this country. So that's what we're dealing with. There are attempts to add things in as amendments to the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, because it's a bill that everybody knows is going to pass. So there's always an attempt to put riders on this thing, including this time around, there was an attempt to do the Safe Banking Act, which would provide marijuana sellers, you know, opportunity to participate in the federal banking system, essentially. Other marijuana reforms. There was an attempt to have women be conscripted, or I should say eligible for conscription. In this bill, there was an attempt to repeal the authorization of the 2002 Iraq War. There was an attempt to sanction Russians for a gas pipeline. None of that stuff made it in. And another big attempt was to stop the sale of arms to Saudi Arabia. And it had not necessarily that strange of bedfellows. Libertarians and the Democratic Socialists in the Senate joined forces to an attempt to do this, and here is what that looks like.
And we are complicit. We are arming the Saudis and allowing this to happen. Offensive, defensive, they shouldn't get any of our weapons. We should stop selling them any weapons until they stop starving the country of Yemen.
President, I find myself in a somewhat uncomfortable and unusual position of agreeing with Senator Paul.
Yep, and there you go.
He's worked with Rand Paul and Mike Lee, for that matter, on issues like this, particularly when it comes to Saudi arms sales before. But, like, unfortunately, the narrow libertarian-like consensus of Mike Lee and Rand Paul is not enough to overcome the over... and plus Bernie Sanders and, you know, sometimes someone like Ron Wyden or whatever, like that. That's not enough to overcome the overwhelming Washington consensus that Saudi Arabia needs more and more weapons to continue a right. de facto genocide in Yemen.
And I imagine the administration right now is a little nervous about Saudi Arabia throttling gas supplies,
yes,
world oil supplies, and the price of oil going up. And so there it is.
But Biden should be, this should be a little bit more from the left of, like, I know some people are calling it out, but it's important to do so more. Biden's campaign promise was that after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, that he was going to be tougher on Saudi Arabia. And now, because there is this pushback in the Senate, the Biden administration just put out a press release yesterday basically saying, we need to further this arms sale. Like, we need to basically, I mean, the subtext is that they need to mend the relationship with Mohammed bin Salman, who's mad that there was this rhetoric and was withholding some oil. So that's the transaction that's happening here. And the Biden administration completely reneged on what they said they were going to do.
Well, they were tough with that rhetoric.
Yeah, I guess.
That stinks.
Strongly worded.
That really stinks. We will discuss more, I imagine, in the coming weeks. In the meantime, before we get to Professor Jonathan Levy, author of Ages of American Capitalism, A History of the United States, a couple words from our sponsors. We concluded the drive with Sunset Lake, and don't know the exact numbers, but I can tell you it is well into the five figures we're going to be Sunset Lake and the Majority Report are going to be donating to Give Directly. And I've talked about Give Directly in the past. It is a charity which gives money directly to people living in extreme poverty and allows them to determine what's the best way for them to deploy those resources. How did I find that charity? I found it through GiveWell. And I don't know that there's a relationship between those other than GiveWell recommends it, because GiveWell is a site and I guess an organization spends over 20,000 hours each year, and they research charitable organizations. They recommend only a few that they find to have the highest impact, evidence-based charities that they have found. And they provide all the work, obviously. Over 50,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $750 million. It's going to save tens of thousands of lives and improve the lives of millions. The best part, GiveWell is completely free. They publish all of their research and recommendation on their site, and they do it for free. There's no sign-up required, nothing. They allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charity you choose without taking a cut. So like I say, I've been given now to Give Directly for a couple of years that I found basically through GiveWell. I think they were like interested in advertising on the show. I did all the research about them as an organization, but then also found Give Directly, and that's the one I use. But there's other charities that they list on there. And again, all evidence-based in terms of their efficacy. If you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched to up to $250 before the end of the year, or as long as matching funds last. To claim your match, go to givewell.org, pick podcast, and enter Majority Report with Sam Cedar at checkout. Make sure they know that you heard about GiveWell from the Majority Report, and you'll get your donation matched up to $250. Pretty awesome. Meanwhile, my daughter, out of the blue two or three days ago, comes out of the bathroom. She goes, "I love that Native stuff."
Wow.
Yeah. Well, they have, I use the Native deodorant that is not, that is unscented. I've told this story a million times before about my hygiene practices in the past. I was always worried about having, you know, stuff like, that is in the typical antiperspirant and stuff like that, enter my body. I didn't want any of that. Native has none of that, but they also have like shower gels and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. And so I have those products, and my daughter just loves it.
It's hard to elicit that strong of a response from a teenager. So that's how you know.
They have these, apparently they, holiday inspired scented products. And the one that she loves is the candy cane, underarm deodorant and the body wash.
Wow.
I mean, it's crazy. She loves it. Native is all about stopping the stink the right way. That's the Native difference. Their mission is to overhaul your entire hygiene routine by creating products that are made with simple ingredients like shea butter and coconut oil so you can smell great all day long. Try their holiday scented deodorant, body wash, or toothpaste in scents like candy cane, sugar cookie, and fresh mistletoe. And the thing I like about these things, I mean, most people don't have my idiosyncratic problems with smell, but they don't smell floral. Floral things I have a problem with. But these things, they smell great. They're fun. Give the gift of self-care. It's easy with Native. Build yourself or your loved ones personalized product bundles by mixing and matching three of your favorite holiday scented products into a set. Stay merry, happy, and fresh this holiday season. You'll love Native's limited-time seasonal products as much as I do, and in particular, my daughter does. I don't know if you're going to love it as much as my daughter does. She goes crazy over this stuff.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying, though. Like, it's hard to impress teenagers.
It's very hard. Go to nativedeodorant.com. Use the code MajorityReport. Get 20% off your first purchase at checkout. That's nativedeodorant.com. Code MajorityReport for 20% off. nativedeodorant.com. Code is Majority Report. And lastly, still, I think there's still time, folks, for Christmas to get the gift that you can be sure nobody else is going to get somebody. Mm. You know what it is.
I know. I do.
Like, you do it.
It's cheeky grin.
Exactly.
You have on.
Yes. A hello tushy bidet.
Cheeky, yeah.
Now just
that was
listen.
Unintentional.
Well done.
It was, I mean, I meant it.
Well done. Emma will be leaving us to write copy for all the Hello Tushy ads. The Hello Tushy bidet checks all the boxes. It is useful, but definitely unique, high-tech, but affordable, eco-friendly. It's one of those gifts that you can give to someone and they didn't know they desperately wanted it until they have it and start using it. I am telling you. The Hello Tushy bidet cleans your butt way better than wiping, and it cuts toilet paper use down by 80%. As if you're familiar with a bidet, you know it washes your bum with fresh water for a much better clean. You just spray and you pat dry. And the best thing about the Hello Tushy bidet, you don't need a plumber. You don't need electricity. It attaches to your toilet in about 8 minutes. Anybody can do this. The complete Tushy system turns your restroom into your best room. With the Tushy bidet attachment, the ottoman, the toilet brush, and the Tushy stand-in tissues, you can join millions of happy butts falling in love with Hello Tushy. And I don't know, at least tens or hundreds from who've taken us up on this offer from this show, because I hear from people about this all the time, because it really does. It's like one of those few things that, like, it changes you as a person. Give the gift of a clean bum to yourself or your loved ones this holiday season. Get 10% off free shipping right now at hellotushy.com/majority. That's 10% off plus free shipping. That's hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off and free shipping. Don't forget to tag Hello Tushy on social to celebrate your clean butt. Of course, we will put links to this in all of our podcasts and YouTube descriptions, Twitch, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Check them out now. And don't forget, you can become a member of the show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Joining us now, Jonathan Levy, professor of history at the University of Chicago, author of Ages of American Capitalism, A History of the United States. Professor, welcome to the show here with Emma Viglin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Your book basically tracks capitalism in this country and the sort of historical the forces outside of capitalism that were implicating American capitalism. But let's just start with some basic assumptions that you make going in.
Sure.
And the first obvious one is, like, what is capitalism? To get a little bit remedial here, but I think from my academic days, that was always the important thing. Get the assumptions out of the way early.
Well, you know what? It's not a remedial question at all. I mean, it's a very difficult question. Capitalism is one of the more vexed concepts, that one can that one can use. I mean, I start with actually a very, what I think is a commonsensical assumption, is that if we're talking about capitalism, we have to talk about capital. And we need a definition of what capital is. Economists debate that a lot. The definition I use in the book, I think, is also quite simple, which is capital is a form of property. It's a legal asset that generates a future profit. It's legal, so it has to have owners. So if you're going to have capital, you have to have capitalists. And the kind of broader motion in the economy, but also, as you suggested in your opening remark, motion outside of the economy as such, politics, culture, that generates profits out of capital, you know, that process, that system, I think is what makes for a capitalist economy at large, is what makes for capitalism.
How much is the concept of exploitation intrinsic to that, right? Because capital is not just property. Property is property. It's mm-hmm. the way that and how much also is the relationship with labor? I mean, it's easier to conceptualize, I guess, when you're talking about slaves in capitalism, because that was literally slaves were literally property. Ostensibly, your workers are not their property. They're, I guess, selling you the property of their labor, I guess, on some level. But how much of that is necessitates exploitation, right? Because you can't pay for, can't pay what the labor's worth necessarily, or you wouldn't really have a business.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a couple things going on here. So first, typically, understandings of capitalism that point towards labor exploitation as being really fundamental, really being central, tend to be broadly within a Marxist camp. You know, Marx emphasized that the source of profits, the source of surplus value, as he called it, you know, must always be the exploitation of labor. My view is somewhat different. Now, you know, you could juxtapose that to a view that's very typical in mainstream economics today, which is to suggest that profit comes from entrepreneurship, it comes from risk-taking, it comes from equal exchange. It never comes from labor exploitation. My view, I suppose, is somewhat, I don't want to say in the middle, because the middle view is typically wrong. Certainly, there's a lot of profit-making in a capitalist economy that comes from labor exploitation. You could look at the way that workers are forced often in large corporations to work overtime without being compensated, without being paid. That's a source of profits. You mentioned in the past slavery, which is obviously nothing but a system of labor exploitation, and the extent to which slavery was a capitalist economy, and very much it was in U.S. history, labor exploitation is key. But I don't subscribe to the view that labor exploitation is always the source of profits. I think it's very hard to actually make that work when you study the economy. There are other ways to do it. Perhaps innovation and entrepreneurship might be a source of profitability. You know, today, if you want to look at profits, you have to look at monopoly, right? You have to look at the control of markets and the way competition is undermined by the concentration of power, concentration of market power. That might not be exploitation, but it also might be a phenomenon that we don't particularly like, either economically or politically or ethically, that can explain where profits come from. So I think historically, you know, you have to have a theory of capitalism, you're right, to frame the subject. But one of the nice things about history, I think, of course, I'm a historian, is the richness of the subject matter can allow you to be flexible. And depending upon, you know, where you're looking, the time and place, to identify all kinds of sources of profit that drive, you know, capitalism forward. But you're certainly right to point to the labor exploitation issue. It's absolutely central.
Okay, and we will get back to those questions of monopoly as we get to the fourth. You essentially have four eras in which the capitalism within this country has mutated or changed relative to, I guess, the circumstances and the innovation and whatnot. So let's start. Let me just touch on one more thing that you deal with early on. You talk about the importance of different types of liquidity. Can you walk us through, you know, what that means and what the different types of liquidity are that we see throughout the course of the 400 years or some odd 350 years of American capitalism?
Yeah, so my book we've been talking about the kind of big picture issues and these definitional questions. You know, my book is mostly inspired in this respect by Keynes, by the British economist John Maynard Keynes, which often, you know, Keynes is read as a kind of centrist. I think actually Keynes's economic vision was much, much further to the left than is typically realized. And my book is part of other attempts to kind of develop a left social democratic Keynesian vision of what capitalism is and how it works. And absolutely central to that is this issue of liquidity and liquidity preference. Liquidity is a bit of a technical term, but it's not that difficult. You know, a liquid asset for Keynes is one that stores value over time. In a capitalist economy, that's money. So liquidity preference means that owners of wealth, owners of capital, prefer to hoard money as opposed to investing long-term in production, enterprise, employment, and labor, potentially labor exploitation, to go back to the earlier point in our conversation. Keynes also theorizes that all things being equal, owners of wealth prefer liquidity, right? They want to hoard their wealth. They don't want to invest long-term. And the central dynamic of capitalism in this view is the contest between long-term investment, which leads to production, creates economic potential, creates economic possibility, and hoarding behaviors. Keynes pointed to two. First, hoarding cash. Like lots of corporations today just sit on cash. They don't invest it. They don't spend it. It's wasted. Second, and this is a little bit counterintuitive, Keynes also thought of speculation, short-term speculation, as being a kind of hoarding. So instead of committing to the future long-term and creating new economic futures, momentary speculation, it looks like a lot's happening. It looks like energetic, but it actually produces nothing. If we think of kind of stock market booms that are exciting, right? Prices go up, people make money, but they don't generate much in their wake. And so to me, that contest between the short-term hoarding behaviors, which is what capitalists want to do, right? They actually don't want to invest in our futures, and usually political initiatives, oftentimes coming from the state, oftentimes coming from the way that working people contest the ownership of capital, they could push investment. The investment, I think, being the central dynamic in a capitalist economy, can push investment towards the long term and can create new economic futures. So that's where, you know, that's where liquidity comes into the picture.
And I just also want, as we go through this, for people to just note when that dynamic shifts over the course of the history that you lay out, where and we should say that hoarding could also be just sort of, you know, sort of like dynasties, you know, like you know, like the Gates Foundation, you know, the whole Gates enterprise and whatnot.
Inheritance of wealth.
Exactly. And it's just it is the cash stores, if you will, or the near cash stores that are being hoarded. Because ostensibly, I don't know, you know, you never know. Like maybe somebody comes out with a really neat new car that you need to buy. And that's why, or a neat new, rocket. And so you can go to the moon. You want to have that cash in hand to be able to drop that. But that dynamic changes too over the course of our history relative to like sort of the way that society will allow for that type of hoarding or not. But let's start in, you start at 1660. Mm-hmm. Where does you refer to this as the age of commerce. How does this begin essentially in terms of like, how is the capitalism formed at that point within the context of the United States? And as a subsidiary question, how much of it was contingent upon the sort of colonialism and the imperialism that we had? I sort of feel like this era, compared to my daughter who thinks that she's running a business by selling the clothes that I've bought her on Depop, thinks she's making money, but she doesn't sort of like realize that the initial thing, like I gave her money in the form of clothes and she's selling it on some level. That's like the way that the capitalism started in this country.
Yeah. You know, so beginnings are tricky, you know, origins are It's a very tricky subject because any historian can tell you, you know, you deal with one origin and it always points back to the next origin and you keep going back and back and back and you end up at the Big Bang. So I started in 1660, you know, precisely because it foregrounds the issue that you brought up. You know, the centrality of empire to the origins of capitalism in the United States, specifically the British Empire. So the 1660s, coming after the English Civil War, it's a period known as the restoration of the British monarchy following the Civil War. And it's a moment when the British Empire, really for the first time, asserts control over North America, imperial control over North America, and sees the spread of commerce as being what was called then an affair of state, being really central to the British imperial project. And so you see the politics and the economics fuse together, and a spread led by the state, but also merchants, also slave owners who bring African forced labor to the southern United States. You see this political effort to bring together an imperial system that's going to further a certain kind of economic development that's commercial. And in that commercial effort, I think you see, you know, the beginnings of capitalism in North America.
How did you find specifically that the British organized, I guess, the colonies or North America more broadly in a way that was most efficient to benefit the capitalists?
Yeah, so actually, probably the leading factor at that time was warfare. So in this period, there's multiple European empires who are competing for territory and seeing commerce as a potential source of imperial wealth, mostly through taxation. And so what the British do is they create essentially a free trading zone within the empire, but one that's militarily protected by the Royal Navy. And so you see state power through violence, through conflict and war making, kind of creating the space necessary for the evolution of what we would think of as something like a free market.
Walk us through here this is, I mean, this is a long period of time, I guess, you know, 1860 to 1860, but it is marked essentially by the same thing, is just the extraction of resources from this country, that the sort of commodification of them, and also the sort of parallel commodification of human beings, both as a commodity and as a mechanism in which to drive the commodification of in particular cotton, I guess. Talk about that interplay and how that develops over the course of essentially leading up to the Civil War.
Yeah, so maybe 2 points. So first, the central dynamic in this age of commerce from 1660 to 1860 in the book is really geopolitical. So the way to spread commerce is to spread commercial production, as you said, commodity production across space. That requires colonization. It involves moving people into new territories and involves conquering, given the presence of Native American peoples and polities. So the state does that through its war making powers. But in terms of spreading commerce in this period, slavery and coerced African labor emerges as one of the really most dynamic ways to move commercial production across space. The most valuable commodities, you mentioned cotton, really the era starts with sugar in the British Caribbean, also other commodities like rice or indigo, things of this nature. Those parts of the world, the Caribbean, the southern United States, they're not places, because of climate, because of diseases, they're not places that free migrants will choose to go. And so the coercion through enslavement is really important to moving labor into these regions. And I argue in the book that one of the effects of slavery is not just to produce commodities through coerced labor, but within the imperial system to create a whole series of commercial relationships. So if you're going to have slaves spend their entire time laboring to produce sugar to sell back to Britain, you know, New England becomes a place that grows food or through the fishing industries can provide subsistence provisions for slave plantations. And so I use Adam Smith, a very familiar Smith's argument about about the ways in which commercial relationships, markets can fuel growth, to show there's a division of labor in this period that's very much, you know, centered in slavery. And so, you know, given that that's the theme, you start with the spread of slavery in the 1660s. It's part of the British Imperial Project. And really what ends the era is the Civil War and the geopolitical question of whether or not slavery is going to be allowed in the Western territories, right? Can slavery continue to spread? And Lincoln and the Republican Party say no. And at that point, you know, we have the outbreak of the Civil War and this period ends.
Do you think that American capitalism, you know, to the extent that we're telling the story of capitalism, could it have existed without slavery? I mean, could it have been born without it? I mean, again, it's sort of like this dynamic with my daughter. She very well may go on to sort of, you know, sell the jeans that I got her for, you mm-hmm. know, enough money that she can then buy two other pieces of clothing and build her clothing empire. But yeah. if it wasn't for me buying those jeans in the first place, she would not be able to get this thing started. Could capitalism have worked without that level of exploitation of basically free stuff to begin with? I mean, it's sort of like, you know, I don't know. Could Donald Trump have a dollar to his name right now if he didn't get that money from his dad or however you want?
The math suggests no, since I think if he just put it in index fund, he would have had more. Right.
But I think the answer to the last question is definitely no. I think the earlier questions are a bit more complicated. I mean, you know, in the abstract, sure. You know, I think we're talking about capitalism. We have to talk about capitalism in the plural. So certainly we know that there can be capitalisms without slave labor. We've had one since the Civil War, you know, in this country. With that said, I mean, go ahead.
But I mean, everything that we had, you know, we got to the point where that slavery, and I don't know, and I guess this is a subsidiary question that I want to ask you. Could we have seen the growth of industrial capitalism that really is the next era that you're talking about without that slavery, even in the North? Wasn't it the ability of generating this labor intensive commodity, ultimately cotton, that you could not have made as profitable and as like commodified, I guess.
No.
Were it not for the fact that we just don't have to pay for the part to really make it on some level.
Yeah, I mean, these are old, important debates in economic history. Some have argued that profits from slavery, you know, directly led to investments in early industrialization. You know, those arguments, those kind of direct connections, right, haven't held up as well. But I still think a weaker version of the same argument, which you're suggesting, you know, has to be true, in the sense that without slavery, the commercial history of the United States would have been greatly diminished. You know, greatly diminished. Would that have meant that capitalism never would have come about? I don't know if I go, you know, that far. It's an interesting counterfactual question, but we can definitely look at what did happen and say that slavery was very important to early American economic development. I think that changes over time. I think it's much more important earlier in this period. I think by the time you're in the 1840s and 1850s, you're seeing an industrial capitalism develop in the North, which starts to look different. Now, and then I'll just say one more thing. You know, slavery is the most awful form of coerced labor, but it's not the only kind of coerced labor. So even when capitalism doesn't depend on slavery as such, it still oftentimes, depends upon or draws from, you know, coercion of labor. And that's something we have to be mindful of, you know, across periods.
Before we get into this next period, let me just ask you one more question, too. How the Louisiana Purchase, and in particular the Haitian Revolution, plays into this? I mean, as a factor in changing the course of capitalism as we head towards this next era?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a very specific point, which is that without the revolution in Haiti, very likely Napoleon doesn't decide to sell Louisiana to the United States. And so that's a very significant. Second, I argue in the book that despite the American Revolution, it's very important, But it's not a much of a discontinuity in the book. You know, it's in the middle of the same age as I have it. And that actually what the Louisiana Purchase does for the United States is it means that the United States kind of looks like the 18th century British Empire. Instead of having slave colonies in the Caribbean with an industrial metropole in the north and then provisioning from the northeast colonial America at the time, instead we have this very thriving plantation complex rooted in cotton that emerges out of Louisiana that's connected commercially to the rise of Chicago, cities like that in the Midwest that focused on grain, that focused on food, that focused on provisions, and then industrialization in the northeast. So it creates a certain kind of continuity that makes the United States look like other imperial powers in the same era that were dependent upon slave labor.
All right. Well, let's move to the second, what you call book two, but the second era of, and you entitle it The Age of Capital. In this instance, you're talking about capital almost in a more specific way, in the way that machinery, I guess you would more or less. Yes.
Well, that's two things. I mean, one, the title Age Capital actually is somewhat of an homage to an earlier historian who's my favorite historian, who's the inspiration for me for writing this book, which is Eric Hobsbawm, who was a really important Marxist historian in the 20th century. He had an Age of Capital, so I wanted to have one too. I suppose what makes my Age of Capital look a little bit different than his is he focused on the rise of industrialization. As you said, the factories, the machines, that's really important. I mean, the Industrial Revolution is the greatest break in human history since, 10, 12,000 years ago with the transition from hunting and gathering to settler agriculture. It's very new. People are living in cities. They're working in factories. Wage labor becomes the dominant, form of work. So it's a huge break. With that said, I think there's another dynamic that's as essential to capital in this period as the factory system, and that's the financial dynamics. The credit cycle, boom and bust, and again, this contest between the side of kind of long-term investment and production, which we would associate with Industrial Revolution, and then this side of kind of short-term speculation, boom, bust, hoarding. And you can see that in this period as well. And it's one of the reasons why this period begins with the Civil War and arguably the first kind of modern financial panic, which happened in 1873. In the 1870s, people at the time referred to it as the Great Depression. Although I think quite rightly, we think of the Great Depression as occurring in the 1930s. And that's the end of this period, because you get this, extraordinary boom through Fordism, through the turn to the assembly line, mass production, but at the same time, the greatest bust in the history of capitalism in 1929 and the outbreak of the Great Depression. So I think we have to find a way to kind of integrate these two subjects, right? The industrial side and then also the financial side.
And we should say there was three major recession, depressions, panics, however you want to call them, prior to the Great Depression. You said 73. There was also like one 20 years later, I think. Mm-hmm. And then
93. That's right.
20 years. I think when the next one was 1907.
That's correct.
One of the things that from your book that I learned that I found fascinating, which I feel like we had a relatively similar dynamic, in the wake of NAFTA, was the advent of agricultural practices, of industrialized agricultural practices in this country, drove emigration to this country. Will you talk about that dynamic?
That's a great catch comparing that to the kind of 1990s period. I have to say I hadn't thought about that. But of course, actually it connects to the slavery issue because, when you come out of the Civil War, you get a highly exploitative system of sharecropping in the South, which keeps black people in the South on the land where they're exploited not by the master's lash, but by credit relationships, by sharecropping. And what that means is that when the United States industrializes in the Northeast, in the Midwest, it has to draw proletarian labor from Europe, right? I mean, so you have a mass proletarian migration from Eastern and Central Europe to the United States. But what drives them off the land in the first place? Well, it's actually the agricultural dimension to the Industrial Revolution in the United States, the rise of plains farming, the rise of Chicago as the great agricultural center, the tremendous increase in productivity on American farms, which leads to exports of grain to Europe, which drives peasants off the land. They can't compete with American grain. They can't compete with American agriculture. And so that population becomes the proletarian migration that ends up working at Andrew Carnegie's steel factories, working in Henry Ford's automobile factories. And so you're quite right to point to this period as an era of globalization in which agriculture is very important to migration patterns.
I mean, we have that dynamic with Mexico in terms of corn. Like our corn is so much cheaper that it drove campesinos off of the land in Mexico, and that's where some of our migrant labor comes from because, an ear of corn and, American ear of corn in Mexico is that much cheaper. And it didn't even occur to me that you could create that type of dynamic across the Atlantic, that it was cheaper.
I want to add, sorry to interrupt you, but that the NAFTA period, the idea would be that with the benefits of free trade, right, that Mexicans who no longer were employed in agriculture would work in factories. But of course, that didn't really happen because of the rise of China, the rise of Chinese supply chains disrupted the whole, vision of what was to transpire.
So you describe this era as both the buildup of industrial mechanisms and some measure of financialization. Can you talk about that relationship where value becomes not necessarily the cost of a thing, but its potential to generate more value?
Yeah. So this relates to the conversation earlier about labor exploitation and its centrality to capitalism. Certainly it is. But, the leading kind of edge of financial speculation in this period had to do with the rise of the railroads. Speculators like Jay Gould, maybe perhaps the more infamous, who would manipulate information, corrupt governments to buy and sell securities and make money that way, as opposed to what they would also do sometimes, actually build railroads, run them efficiently, manage their costs and try to make a profit. But, this gets back to the liquidity point. If you could just speculate in financial markets or just be a rentier, clip bond coupons, and kind of put your feet up on the desk and make profits that way, why would you go through the trouble of having to invest in a factory, employ workers, innovate a product, exploit labor, perhaps manage costs, produce a good, and then worry about competing with other producers in the market to sell that good for a profit? And so actually, I think, that the finance side is kind of the norm. It's what we should expect to happen. And the Industrial Revolution piece of it, which involves production, is more strange, is more difficult to explain. And so you have to look at kind of cultures that emphasize labor and production in the United States, which are very prominent in kind of democratic Republican discourse. You have to look at these kind of strange entrepreneurial histories of guys like Carnegie and Ford who hated speculation, who wanted to produce. You have to look at labor history, the degree to which organized labor and wanting employment and wanting sustenance could kind of force investment out of owners of wealth. And so that's, much of what the Industrial Revolution was about. One more piece is the energy transition. This is the kind of rise of the turn to fossil fuels, which greatly energizes industrial production in this era and makes it more productive. But I think the finance side, to maybe come back to the present, is kind of more what we should expect to see and more what we have today.
It manifests itself, I think, most acutely in something like stock buybacks. I mean, that's an exact definition of what you're saying, what the incentive structure encourages.
Right, and I want to get to that, and like you know, we're seeing it with hedge funds and sort of the these venture groups, and they're just financializing everything, but they can't financialize, right, unless somebody is laying those tracks, as it were, and somebody's building the railroad, right? Like they are parasitic. I don't want to use terms, but their relationship is secondary. This is like, these are side bets on a main game, even if the side bets end up being bigger, right? Like you need the initial, to speculate on the value of your land. It's going to go up because the railroad's going to come through town. You still need to rely on somebody, who's going to be building that railroad, right?
Maybe, you know, maybe. I mean, you know, today we talk about in politics, like conservatives, the bridge to nowhere to prove the inefficiency of government. You know, there are a lot of capitalists who built railroads to nowhere in the 1870s and the 1880s, where the whole thing was just to show, to make people think that this was going to be a railroad that would bring production online and could be profitable, when really the whole, it was nothing but, right, a kind of shadow sort of theater to promote a financial speculation. That wasn't all that happened.
It's like a pump and dump.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So you know, the railroads were built. They moved goods. They moved freight. They employed people. That's important to suggest. But there always is this possibility that it's nothing but a confidence game, and the dynamics of finance and speculation can just take over, right, and can subordinate that productive economy.
I frankly think that's sort of where we are today. But
I agree.
Before we get there, where are we in terms of class consciousness during this era? Because there's a lot of like sort of there's a lot happening on the labor side. I mean, early in this, I mean, post Reconstruction, you're going through, or I should say Reconstruction, you have populist movements. And then you have, you know, the silver, you know, get us unpegged from gold. I mean, yep. We have populist movements at this point, and then also a lot of labor movements that are happening, in part because we have these immigrants who are coming in from that type of tradition.
Yeah, I mean, so very important to say, you know, because in the 20th century, the United States never developed a labor party, like a labor socialist party, like many European states did. Then people think, well, actually, labor class conflict, you know, hasn't been important to American history. It's not true. It's very important to say that in this period of industrialization, the United States, whether you look at the incidence of strikes, the incidence of actual violence and labor conflict, the United States has the most contentious labor history of any country in the world. And oftentimes it's fueled by immigrants who are drawing from European ideologies of socialism or republicanism. But the ideology is homegrown American democracy, right? The idea that to be a citizen in a republic means you should own property and control your own labor, and that the wage system undermined that democratic promise. It's very important to the class struggles of the 19th century. Over time, because of the degree to which employers were willing to fight unionization, because the state, mostly the courts, until the New Deal, strike activity is not legal. You can get injunctions at courts to break strikes. Class consciousness in the United States goes down a particular path in which workers who join the American Federation of Labor under Samuel Gompers give up on those kind of older property aspirations, the idea that being a citizen means owning property, and begin to want to bargain over things like wages and working conditions. And so by the time you get to the early 20th century, for better or for worse, I mean, you could have a different opinion about this, but undoubtedly class consciousness narrows down a particular track where organized workers accept the wage, they accept the wage bargain as the game that's going to be played, and begin to battle over wages and working conditions. And that's the kind of labor conflict that gets legally codified, you know, ultimately by the New Deal.
Is that and then sort of usurped with Taft-Hartley?
Diminished, yeah.
But is that what you just described in terms of that that acceptance by labor at the hands of a court in particular that was incredibly hostile to labor versus capital? Would you describe that as a I guess a battle lost? I mean, or maybe the war on some level was lost, and the rest was, you know, commentary, as it were?
I think so. I think you could say some battles won, war lost. I mean, the legitimation of unionization, of collective bargaining, huge, you know, watershed moments in U.S. history. At the same time, you know, I argue in the book, the chapter on class conflict, that there were labor visions of the 19th century about what it means, you know, to live in a democracy, and what should economic life and the distribution of property, the distribution of capital, you mentioned the greenbacks, the distribution of credit, you know, what does democracy demand of the economy in this respect? So I think the 19th century is a gold mine you know, visions about the economy that maybe, you know, you'd have to translate them into contemporary circumstances, but are inspirational and perhaps, you know, usable in our times.
What role too, and not to just get hung up on this period, but as opposed to, like, say, European socialist movements where they were more mm-hmm. fairly concentrated, like, what role did the decentralization of, I guess, you know, there was a lot of transients during this time period, right? Laborers or working class people were not sticking in one place at one period of time. There was a large growth out of cities as well, too. Like, what role did that kind of disbursement play in not allowing for labor to be more concentrated and powerful?
It was quite significant. So I think you're right. You can point to strikes, you can point to conflict, but as far as unity and solidarity in the national sense, or across industries. So, and this is like kind of technical weeds type stuff with labor law, but, you know, one of the kinds of labor injunctions that employers could get was that you couldn't have sympathy strikes, right? So, you know, to try to isolate, this is still true today. I mean, the United States has a very balkanized system of labor law that really prevents solidarity across industries, across trades. It's something that the labor movement now is actually trying to contest. It's been trying to pass legislation without much success to try to create more of a kind of national solidarity along the lines that you're suggesting. You know, I want to mention one more thing. That's all right. I know maybe we have to move on. That's important too, is that the labor movement by the early 20th century, you know, really buys a middle-class vision of gender too, which undermines its potency. You know, the idea that women don't belong in the remunerative labor force, and that you need, one of the reasons why you need to have the power to bargain over wages is to lift up the wages of men so they can be male breadwinners. So if there's many kind of usable traditions from the 19th century labor movements, that's not one of them. But I mean, that's important to this period too.
Was that a resurgence of an ideology, or was that pre-existing or latent?
Well, it's a middle class ideology that comes out of the 19th century. That's oftentimes, even for the middle class, more ideology than fact, because even as you remove women from the remunerative labor force, maybe they're not working for money, for wages, but they're still engaging in all kinds of work in the household, which is a kind of hidden source of labor exploitation and profits in that sense, even if it's not monetized. So it's a middle-class vision, and it's one that parts, not all, of the American labor movement by the early 20th century have subscribed to, right? That we need to have higher wages so that we can keep our women out of the labor force. So it becomes a kind of aspirational emblem of middle-class respectability.
And I think that leads to, like, kind of what we romanticize as traditionally union jobs, right? Like, say you're working in a steel mill you're working in a factory, right? Like, that was an incredibly grueling labor, but, like, that's what the vision of what organized labor became in the United States came from, I would imagine.
Yep, yep. I mean, that gets enshrined in the New Deal political order across the 20th century, this ideal of male breadwinning as being really central to the political economy.
We should say also, I mean, to a large extent, white male breadwinning is developing here. And we see that in the context of, you know, who does and doesn't qualify for Social Security when we pass that act, right? I mean, that's why you don't have home health care workers. You don't have farm workers qualifying for Social Security at that point. This was the beginnings of, I mean, I guess it's, you got to read the book to figure out how that, what cemented what or what the development of that was, but that was sort of teed up on some level, for it to be, codified, I guess, in the context of the New Deal. And this is as we move into, book three, The Age of Control. Let's jump up. I mean, the New Deal, I think we have a sense of the Reformation that happens there. But let's move to what you call the post-war hinge. What is that about?
Yeah, so there's a whole family of different explanations about what the New Deal was, how radical it was, how conservative it was. You know, some at the time saw the New Deal as being socialist or communist. I think that's not the case. Others have seen the New Deal as being a conservative in its attempts to kind of restore capitalism, put it back together. A long history here, we probably shouldn't get too much into the weeds, but my argument is that actually we don't really know what the New Deal was about until after World War II, in part because World War II involved, you know, huge public investment programs, huge public interventions into the economy to win the war, which kind of scrambled the politics of the 1930s or put many of the politics of the 1930s up for grabs in the context of the war. And so you have to get out of the war before you can really see what the New Deal is about. And I argue that the New Deal was about a few things. First, it's about regulating finance. It's about constraining the role and power of finance in the economy. Second, it's what I call a politics of income. So it's going to leave investment in private hands, corporate hands, because this is an era dominated by large corporations like General Motors, Ford, et cetera. And it's going to redistribute income after investment and after production have occurred through collective bargaining. We've been talking about that, through the welfare state. We've mentioned Social Security, and also through philanthropy, which I think is a kind of unappreciated dimension of the New Deal political order. So that's what it's about, regulating finance in the interest of trying to move investment into production, but leaving investment in private hands and then redistributing income after it's taken place. The third thing, you know, I'd mentioned why the post-war period is really important, you know, is the rise of the Cold War. And so ideologically, the Cold War sets a very hard left edge on just how far to the left the New Deal can go. I mean, you mentioned Taft-Hartley, which was a labor law passed after the war that diminished the Wagner Act, the Wagner Act of 1935, which first legitimated collective bargaining. So I think after the war, we see the New Deal shift a little bit to the right, and that really establishes what the New Deal order is going to look like in the post-war decades.
Can you just explain, you mentioned the middle aspect of the distribution of income after investment. What would have been an alternative to that?
Right. So we talked about this a little bit, you know, with those 19th century labor visions. I think the alternative is is politicizing capital, right? Who owns capital? On what terms? Where, right? Politics decides investment should go. What should society invest in collectively, given our collective priorities as a public, right? As a democratic polity. So that's the alternative. And you don't have that in the New Deal. It's fundamental weakness. And I think, you know, the word nostalgia came up earlier. I think it's, you know, the New Deal did many, many things. We talked about, you know, labor law. We could talk about an era of equality, income equality relative to what we have now. So many things that were better now than then. But to be nostalgic for the New Deal, I think, is very misplaced. It had some real flaws, and this issue of investment where we started talking about what we were talking about definitions of capitalism, it's weak there. It doesn't have robust programs of public investment, and it leaves investment in private hands. And so that's going to lead to problems, which is why the New Deal order breaks up.
Okay, so I mean, just to be a little bit more tangible, so that people understand, yeah. That could have been, instead of like having private railroads, you have the public own the railroad. Instead of having, power generated privately, you could have the public generate
I'm glad you. I mean, I'm glad you pressed, because that issue, you know, shows how the Cold War just muddied everything, right? Because the rhetoric, the politics is, well, we have to have a kind of Soviet command and control economy or free enterprise over here, right? So investment is in private hands, or the state has to own everything. But no, there's all kinds of things you can do in the middle. So you can have mixed public-private kinds of partnerships. You can have the state be involved at the regional or local level in providing access to capital and credit for private parties who don't have access to it through the normal banking system, which is dominated in Wall Street or controlled by, you know, corporations, to go back to the monopoly issue. You could have
New Deal,
that's at one point during the war proposed regional investment trusts that would try to, you know, make capital accessible to parts of the country that didn't have access to capital, or to people, speaking of white male breadwinners, who didn't have access to capital. So I think there is a role for public ownership in many respects. I mean, you talked about power generation. I mean, you know, I wouldn't say that's always wrong, but there's lots of different policies one could imagine, and people have imagined, that would politicize capital and politicize capital ownership and investment, instead of saying, okay, we're going to let, you know, the economy run on private investment, and then we're going to try to fix everything after production has taken place, right, post hoc, by redistributing income, which is something we should also do, don't get me wrong, but has its limits, right? Has its own limits.
Right. The analog to that argument was, you know, after the repeal of Glass-Steagall under the Clinton administration, it comes back up in 2000 in the wake of the financial crisis. Do we just not allow this type of behavior to exist, or do we allow it to exist and try and fine tune it so that it doesn't become the potential catastrophe that it was, I guess, 10, 12 years ago? And it's that type of, I guess, mentality. We can fix it after the fact.
That's exactly right.
Let's move a little bit forward, maybe a little quicker than I'd want to, but, you know, for the sake of time, and we get up, how does this era end and lead us into what is essentially a new era of neoliberalism, I guess, that has been, you know, waiting and growing, I guess, since Mont Pelerin, and just waiting for their opportunity, and guys from your school waiting for their opportunity.
And can I ask, I have an addition to that question too, like, how did some of the Cold War dynamics that you mentioned earlier, did they cement themselves during this era where, like, everything became existential? It's either private investment, or it can't be public investment, and that kind of like heightens some of these neoliberal rocket ship.
Yeah, so that's right. And I think there's one account of the more recent period, the period we're in, which I think is wrong, which sort of goes like this, which is, you know, in 1980, Ronald Reagan's elected, and then all neoliberal hell breaks loose, and here we are. And I think, no, you have to kind of look at the post-war period, some of the continuities across the post-war period, and you have to understand why the New Deal order failed during the 1970s. Now, it failed most tangibly because there was an era of inflation during the 1970s. But the fundamental weaknesses of the New Deal order, I think, were two. One, which we talked about, is you're leaving investment in private hands. There's a crisis of profitability in the 1970s, And so there's capital flight. There's capital flight from the in terms of deindustrialization, and there's global capital flight, which undermines the economic anchor of the New Deal order, which was the expectation that there'd be sufficient private fixed productive investment to anchor the economy. And then second, we've also mentioned, you know, that the New Deal order privileged a particular individual, the white male breadwinner, and there's all kinds of politics coming out of the civil rights movement that's going to destabilize that as well. So by the time you're in the 1970s, you know, you have a liberal political order that's in crisis, and it should have been in crisis, you know, given its fault lines and its weaknesses. In the book, I argued that the central event that gets us into the new order is the Volcker shock. That's when the chairman of the Federal Reserve, or Carter, and a lot of deregulation efforts, you know, too, began under Carter, not under Reagan, which is important to note, began under the Democratic Party. Paul Volcker is appointed the new chairman of the Federal Reserve by President Carter to try to tame the inflation crisis. And he jacks interest rates up to, you know, extraordinarily high degrees. It causes a very sharp recession from 1980 to 1982. And when you come out of the Volcker shock, that's when you're in a new age. It's a new age defined by short-termism, by a shift in investment towards finance, by a dependence upon debt, and just the absence of wage growth for most Americans. And that's defined the, you know, this economic period from the 1980s, you know, till today, I think it's fair to say.
Was the response to that recession that was created by basically making money so expensive, how much of what Reagan did in that era, how predetermined was that outcome, I guess I should say, coming after that recession? Like, had it not been Reagan in some fashion, but of course, you know, maybe it would inevitably had to be because of that, but had, you know, I don't know, I mean, I'm trying to come up with somebody who could have been the hero in that moment. But had it been, had there not been someone who said, like, you know what, let's lower the taxation on capital. Let's allow for stock buybacks. Let's really promote all these things that are going to create the financialization of our economy and maybe culminate ultimately, you know, 20 years later. Like, what would have happened, or what could have happened?
So Reagan's an important politician because how much he changed the terms of political debate about economic questions, right? With respect to taxation, with respect to how we should think about regulation. So he's very important there. With that said, I mean, when Reagan came into office, he said, we're going to cut taxes. We're going to liberate the market. There's going to be a national manufacturing revival. You know, the trade deficit will end, the savings rate will go up. I mean, everything Reagan promised economically, like the exact opposite happened. So he changes the tone in politics, he changes the rhetoric, and that's very important. But I think the presidency that actually installs the new regime is the presidency of Bill Clinton. When you look at the actual legislation with respect to finance, and you actually get a coherent, you know, Reagan says it's going to be a manufacturing revival. The exact opposite happened. You know, Clinton, you know, especially after 94, after triangulation, after they lose the Congress, where he shifts to the right, you know, they came up with a very coherent vision of a center left vision of globalization that's going to be finance led, which says we have to liberate capital, right? We have to aid capital mobility, and that's going to lead to a kind of equality of opportunity, and it's going to work out to the benefit of all, except it didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. That tiny part didn't work out that way. I guess, you know, and so that ultimately, I mean, I think it becomes, I think you write it at one point, the capitalism of leveraging asset price appreciation, right? I mean, this is, we're in the full financialization where so much of money and wealth is generated now in this country. It seems continue to unabated through either financialization or monopolization, right? I mean, that seems to be where our capitalism is today.
Yeah, so, you know, I argue in the book that you know, since 1980, you see income generation shift. It shifts from pay, it shifts from labor, that politics of income I was talking about, and income generation shifts towards property, towards owners of property, towards owners of capital. And income games on the property side get leveraged up by the use of debt. And so if you use debt to make an investment with your own property, you make a higher rate of return because you're on your property, because you're using less of your property, you know, to make the investment, because you're using debt. You know, that's true of real estate. It's true of all kinds of, you know, financial markets, from stock markets to bond markets. And that's the game. And that produces income at the very top of the distribution, which then has all kinds of effects on the labor market all the way down. So it creates employment demand in the service industries for things you mentioned, home healthcare workers, but the service industries, food, shopping, retail services. And so you get this economy that's very heavy at the top and very heavy at the bottom as services increasingly replace the industrial sectors of the economy. You mentioned also the monopoly question. I think that's more recent, the last two decades, in the kind of leading edges of the economy that had to do with technology, the rise of large companies that oftentimes control their markets.
I mean, I feel like that's most prominent in tech just because we talk about it that much. Yeah. But it seems to me that it's been going on for the two decades, and the table was set during the Clinton years, where there was just more deregulation and a sort of it felt like there was some, but it was, to the extent that there was like any exercise of antitrust stuff, it seemed to be focused only on things like tech. Technology, like there was a sense that technology was going to come in, so all of a sudden we take it off of all the other industries, and we get the repeal of the Sinn Féin laws and the Telecommunications Act. And all right, well, so let me ask you this: as we start to wrap this up, an impossible question for you.
Okay.
Absent of a pandemic. Is there some type of progression as you look back over the 200 years where you could sort of like there's a trajectory where you could perhaps, and I know as a historian this is not your job, but where you could perhaps get a sense of what the trajectory was, to the extent that there was, has the pandemic changed the dynamic right now, at least as of now, in terms of labor, power in this country? And who knows if it's going to be durable. There's some who are arguing that it will. Is the pandemic going to fundamentally alter that trajectory?
Well, you quite rightly, it's an impossible question, but I won't dodge it. I mean, I think the answer is yes. Of course, we have to see. I mean, I argue in the book, really stops in 2010, it stops with the turn to austerity in 2010, that actually, given the depths of the crisis in 2008, that it looked like it could be a turning point, a new age of American capitalism. But instead, in terms of the economics, it didn't happen at all. Actually, the Obama administration very competently, put that capitalism that existed since the 1980s back together. And that's the economy we really still had going into the pandemic. With that said, politics and the kind of sensibility around, is the economy doing well or not, that's really shifted over the last 10 years. So I think that kind of neoliberal age has fractured. I think Trump especially contributed towards fracturing it by turning to economic policies, some that were right out of the Reagan playbook, like tax cuts, but others, trade, are very, anathema to typical conservative, or even, the kind of 1990s high tide of trade liberalization. So I think even before the pandemic, it's not clear what, right? But it's clear that things are breaking up. it's clear, I think, to most people who are, you know, even remotely, you know, wise about these issues, the levels of inequality in the economy are just not sustainable. They're not sustainable economically. They're not sustainable for our politics, or they're not sustainable socially. So I think even before the pandemic, the mood was very much that something's gotta give here. And the pandemic so far, we've seen both in terms of the fiscal side of realizing that the government has much more financing capacity, you know, to do the things that we need to be done that we had realized before. And then the labor side too, where there's arguably kind of like a strike wave, right? Like a general strike, much like we saw coming out of World War II, I think a very similar episode. And we'll see how much leverage, you know, working people can get on the economy coming out of that. But I think things are changing, and you know, I we'll see what happens. But very likely we're entering into an age of capitalism with very different qualities.
Jonathan Levy, professor of history at the University of Chicago. The book is Ages of American Capitalism, A History of the United States. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm and in the podcast and YouTube description. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm off camera, but appreciate it.
Great.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, folks.
I'm back now.
She's back.
I'm sorry. We went long.
What did you do? Have lunch?
No. I did not have lunch.
What?
Like you had some maybe cashews or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a handful of cashews, yes.
Okay. All right.
But, I mean.
You don't need to apologize for that. I was
just making sure.
Don't call it lunch, though.
Yeah.
Right. I just had a sandwich.
Okay.
Just kidding.
That's no problem.
Really. No.
Folks! We went long.
Right. I mean, I just couldn't.
I understand.
I had to run.
I have something to add, actually, though.
Please.
You know, you asked the question about if capitalism could have existed without slavery. We've got a quote from Joshua Gee, a British merchant publicist and writer in economics in 1729, so right in the middle of the 1660 to 1860 time. And he just says this simply, all this great increase in our treasure proceeds directly. Let me take this one more time. All this great increase in our treasure proceeds chiefly from the labor of Negroes in the plantations. So there you go. That's 1729.
And an observer on the IM says, regarding the origins of capital and capitalism, I'm paraphrasing, but I'm reminded of a Kurt Vonnegut quote, every great fortune started with a crime. I really do think that it's like it is the, with all due respect to my daughter, whom I love, it is the Mila scenario where
primitive accumulation of Depop.
Well, she just believes that she has, you know, created a business, and it doesn't understand that it's really just trading off of what I gave her.
No, it's the monopoly study phenomenon, right? Where you give a group of people an unfair advantage, and they. Even though when they start winning in the Monopoly game, it's like that psychological experiment from a few decades back. They
right.
believe that they actually earned it and are better at the game.
Yeah,
right.
Often royal monopolies, like the DuPont family, I'm pretty sure had like the gunpowder monopoly or something like that, going back to feudal
yeah.
times. Or you have what replaced the feudal like sort of monopoly of just the copyright or trademark or whatever you have. I own this oil because I have the land rights to it, for instance.
Right. It starts with the theft of resources. Or of property. And then it's like, look at what we built. Well, yeah, sort of.
I mean, I think he was just being, you know, careful by saying it's a counter.
Oh, no,
I agree with a lot of what he said. Yeah, I don't know how you can prove it, but that is my, you know.
That's
I mean,
our editorial assessment, basically.
Well,
but
I guess, if Mila built this big sort of fashion, empire. She could come back and go like, Dad, if you hadn't given me those jeans, I would have, been able to figure it out myself. And like, maybe, but it's sort of hard to come up with the scenario. Like, where would you have gotten that seed money?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to go out and borrow money from whom?
This yeah. is like the origin of Stella McCartney, the designer, daughter of Paul McCartney. Seriously. I mean,
oh, all right.
Well, no, I just mean she's a famous designer now, and like, wow, would that have? But whatever.
Right, but that's like nepotism. I'm just talking like the pure capital investment. Like,
okay,
we just came in, we stole property, land, resources, labor, and
you're the British Navy, basically, for Myla.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Here's the value. Now do something with it. And she could come back and go like, well, I could have just blown it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not making a personal comment on her. I think she's very adept.
She could have thrown out the jeans and, you know, just
I mean, I'm not saying that she's not entrepreneurial or, you know, has a good head on her shoulders.
The metaphor would require you to be like going to distant lands and stealing clothes and stuff from people, but.
I didn't want to bring that up. I don't want to bring that part up, but.
Right, on Thursdays, Sam sails the high seas.
No, well, I'll tell you what I do.
Steal jeans.
I just go downstairs into the laundry room. I wait for people to wash their clothes. Mom, where's my jeans? And I just scamper up the stairs and run into the apartment. Folks, the other way, try and generate some revenue is... by our members. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show, but you get the fun half too. And you not only support the free show, but you support and get the fun half too. So there's that. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. It is back. Their sale is done. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Check out their coffee. We got the shop is going at shop.majorityreportradio.com, our merch, and of course, the live show, majoritylive.com. And if there's a best of, if there's an interview you want us to include in the best of, send us an email, majorityreporters@gmail.com, put into the subject line, best of, and we will maybe act accordingly. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Tonight David Griscom and I will be joined by Tom and Nisha John to be talking about Barbados going republic, booting the Queen, if that means that they're going to be put in worse servitude by China, as Bloomberg implies, talk about things like that. We'll also be talking about Elon Musk and his little, the most recent publicity tantrum he's throwing about subsidies and stuff like that. So check that out tonight, 8 Eastern, 7 Central Time, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the post game.
Mike Bloomberg or Bloomberg, the paper?
News organization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Damn, they're just like doing the old school communism's going to take root in Guatemala, etc. if we don't act.
Imperial jealous.
Except now it's just China. Good on Biden for restarting some, you know, new Cold War rhetoric, so we can get that all ramped up once again.
I mean, it wasn't just Biden. They've been building this for quite some time.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, this is back. I've told that story many times about that 2000 Hart and Rudman had that threats of the 21st century, and the Cheneys were showing up at that thing talking about China.
The right wing's been doing it for a while, but then you have like the Schumer bill that midwifes it, and then the Biden, whatever. We can talk about this later.
But. Actually, there is a lot to be talked about with that. But let me just say, in terms of the Left Reckoning, how many podcasts, ladies and gentlemen, could you hear an interview? I don't know. What do we do? An hour-long interview with a professor who's basically done a history of American capitalism, and then just at the end, you just get a quote from the 1760s that just sort of... I mean, come on.
1729. And I just want to say real quick, like, he was alluding to, he said, you know, some historians have poo-pooed the idea that investment, the profits from slavery led to direct investment in industrial revolution. I think that's libertarian nerdery. Because
it sounds like critical race theory.
It's obvious that wealth, I mean, like, at the time, they're
well, we've had,
look at all the wealth coming into this country.
As long as we're doing that. We've interviewed on this program at least two or three writers who talked about that dynamic. There was a brief period, I can't remember, 4 or 5 years ago, when there was like three books that came out. The Swedish guy?
Sven Beckert?
Yes. Yes. And there was one or two others. King Cotton. There was one or two other books that we had.
F has never been told, I think.
Yep. And when we get our tagging thing, we'll be able to find those very quickly, right, Bradley? But the outline that argument quite, I think, succinctly and convincingly. Let's put it that way. The other thing, I almost corrected him. I didn't want to, you know, but it passed. Was I wanted to say, like, well, I'm not quite sure that we actually did go from that hunter-gatherer into the agriculture. We just spoke to David Wengrow and the Graeber book, the Dawn of Everything. But, you know, he was working on, mid-1600s up to the present, so we're not going to.
Also, he was excellent, and we don't need to nitpick.
Well, sometimes I can't help it.
Yeah.
Believe me, it's even worse when I'm at home. 646-257-3920 is the number. We head into the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
I see white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on! Come on! Someone needs to pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am in total. Pussy.